Okay, this is camera or sound roll 77 for Fight in the Fields of Paradigm Productions. We have a minus 8 dB reference tone to follow in the modulometer, which equals 0 VU. Okay, this is camera or sound roll 77 for Fight in the Fields of Paradigm Productions. We have a minus 8 dB reference tone to follow in the modulometer, which equals 0 VU. Okay, we're continuing the interview with Jessica Govea. We're on camera roll 161. Our next take is take 11.
Yeah, he'll be home soon.
Do you have an idea of what?
This is take 10, marker.
Okay, Jessica, you had some thoughts on Caesar, I'm sure.
The thing that Caesar was a wonderful leader, and certainly was the one who, had there not been Caesar, there wouldn't have been a farm worker movement, and there wouldn't have been the opportunity for many of us to be a part of that farm worker movement and to gain the successes that we did win. I think personally, the thing that I most appreciate about Caesar was the way in which, when this struggle began in 1965 for many of us, that he let us become a part of the movement if we were willing to do the work. He didn't judge. He didn't say, oh, you're a girl or you're a woman and you can't, therefore you can't do this. He didn't say, you don't have formal education, therefore you can't do that. His approach was, if you're willing to do the job, you got it. If you're willing to take the responsibility, you got it. You've got to really take responsibility and be accountable for what you're doing, but you got it. And that was what made it possible for me to learn how to organize. And that's what made it possible for me to go to Canada and be on the boycott and learn to do the things that I learned to do and to continue to this day to have, my greatest love is organizing. And I thank him for that.
And stop. Do you want some regular tone or have you gotten enough miscellaneous noises? What?
I need to get this. So.
Okay.
If you guys
let's
be quiet
for a minute.
Okay, this is room tone.
Okay, that was a room tone for the interview with Jessica Govea. That's with kids. We don't really have tone without kids. Oh, well. Okay, it's still the 26th of April. This is going to be the interview with Luis Valdez. We're continuing on camera roll 161. Our next take will be take one, starting with take one. Here we go.
Rolling.
This is Luis Valdez, take one, marker.
Okay, Luis, let's start with that winter, the first winter of the strike, that scene I was referring to when the first big impetus was over, the harvest was over, and the fog had come in, and it was cold, and you were out there. And what was that first winter like?
Well, I was a picket captain during that first winter, and I had started in the fall when all the activity was taking place. And it became a matter of serious concern that the work in the fields had changed. And pruning, which takes place in the winter in the fog, is different than the harvest. It is largely men, although some women are involved. And so they were obscured by the fog. The crews were not nearly as large. It was cold and desolate. And the spirit of the strikers visibly sagged, going out every day. You can imagine heading out into the fog at 5:30 in the morning when it's still dark, and then going through the fog looking for scab crews was very debilitating to a lot of strikers. And so it was really necessary to pump up the spirits by having a lot of songs and sometimes just to keep the energy going and sometimes just to be heard. If we couldn't see the workers, it was important that they heard us. So we had the bullhorns out and continued to speak to people. In the fields. As I say, the workers were not nearly as numerous. But we felt the through line, the string of the huelga getting smaller and smaller and tighter and tighter. And something definitely had to be done to not just bolster up the spirit, but to keep the strike literally alive. And it was during that time that Caesar began to plan the march to Sacramento and to think about it. This is in direct response to what they call the little winter, el invierno chico, which hits in February, and there is no work, and there are no crews. We were very afraid in the union that the strikers themselves would begin to take off, that there was no point of focus, that it seemed to us that months were beginning to unravel, you know, the effort of the strike and the spirit of the strike. So we kept it alive as we could. We had different people come out to visit us in Delano. We'd take them out and show them what was happening. But it was, in itself, not a very exciting...
But you had to really work at it during that period. It was an effort. And that really leads us to the beginning, the coming together of the teatro. That grew out of that same impulse of keeping the strike strong, too, didn't it?
The Teatro Campesino started right on the picket line at in the heat of the moment, right? In October, November of the strike. And we had the songs and we had the actos, which we performed on top of flatbed trucks and on top of panel trucks in order to be seen. It wasn't meant as entertainment, and yet it was certainly an attention grabber, you know, in the fields. It focused certain issues, and I think the strikers probably enjoyed it as much as the scabs. But it was a matter of continuing to respond to that vacuum that was being created, you know, by the winter and by the fog. And so the teatro took a definite root in that phase of the strike, and people began to see it for what it was, which was an activity that was directly connected to our spirit. And so we strengthened during that period and performed the Friday night meetings. And of course, we're ready for the March to Sacramento when the teatro became a prime element in the planning of the strike.
Now, I know you'd been involved in theater before the... I'm sorry?
We're very loud. Let me just change the mic.
Okay. We are? Okay. Like, hello. Oh, that's right. This was... I'm sorry. We...
Okay, that's the end of camera roll 161. 162 is next. That was also take one. Take two is next.
Woman, this is take two. Marker?
You were talking a little bit about the beginning of the teatro and how it came out of the picket lines. But people sort of think of theater and union. They don't really understand how it was organic and how it was part of it and how it fed back to the workers and responded to them. Talk a little bit about that relationship between what you created and how people responded.
I didn't know when I approached Caesar that he had a sense of humor, you know, that it was amazing. It again, the public doesn't really know because they didn't get time with Caesar in private quarters, but he told jokes, he told stories, you know, and he loved the concept of the teatro once I presented it to him. I was living in San Francisco when the strike broke out. I was working with the San Francisco Mime Troupe, and Caesar came to San Francisco, and Dolores, too, in the first week or two of the strike, and that's when I approached him. I had already been to Delano right away in the first week, but I didn't get a chance to really talk to him. I was too busy. So I took this opportunity and chased him literally all the way from the Mission District to Oakland over the Bay Bridge, and at the end of the evening finally got a chance to present, you know, to pitch the idea, and he said, sure, come along. The only thing is that you got to know, he says, there's no money, there's no actors, there's no place for you to rehearse. There's no time for you to rehearse even. Do you still want to do it? And I said, absolutely. What a great opportunity. Let me join you, Caesar, right? And so he did. And I went there and found out the conditions were desperate, that every extra minute was really dedicated to planning the picket line and organizing the workers. So we got the teatro going late at night. It was after 9 p.m., after all the picketing work had been done, that we began to gather a small group. And I took some signs with me and organized an improvisational session, basically. I talked about the teatro one night, the first night, and that's on film. But they didn't know what I was talking about. The workers didn't know. One woman raised her hand. I said, any questions after I'd done my spiel? And she said, yes, and she asked me, when does the teatro start? And I realized this is audience. You know, this is not, these are not potential actors. And so I said, well, you're the show, you're the actors, you know. And they were reluctant that first day. So I got the signs out the next time, a couple of days later. We met in the Pink House in the kitchen. And I essentially started to improvise with the workers. I asked them to do what they did on the picket line. And they could do that, as long as someone could do the scab. No one wanted to do the scab, okay? So we got a couple of people that were inclined to be clowns to get out and do the scabs, and they were, you know, shouting epithets and stuff. And so then the strikers began to get into it, and it was an amazing evening because it was like an explosion. It was like the birth of the Teatro Campesino. People were hanging in the windows, and they saw it, and they grasped it. And right after that, we began to do similar stuff on the picket line, and so it began to catch on.
And it really, they owned it. It was their theater.
They were the theater. I mean, they were the audience and they were the actors. There was no distinction. You know, I didn't want a distinction. Why would there be one? And it was not for a purpose of presenting a show. You know, it was not for the purposes of entertaining anybody. It was for purposes of channeling energy and communicating basic kinds of information. And it turns out the use of theater in this very direct way was an educational device that would prove to be very useful. We were able to advance concepts like union contract. A lot of people didn't understand what a union contract was, so we dramatized it, you know. We laid it out. When the Shenley contract was finally signed, we did a huge presentation where the Shenley contract was a character, said Shenley contract on the sign. It was Agustin Lira who was performing, and he had a big pencil, and then the workers were like, you know, being protected by this contract. And we had concepts like seniority, you know, and people understood toilets in the field, they understood cool water, you know, when it's hot. They didn't understand more sophisticated, advanced concepts like seniority, you know, what is that? And so we made a joke of it, you know, one character says, a grower tells a campesino who was Felipe Cantú, I'm gonna take away your seniority. He says, mi señora, no, you're not gonna take away my señora. And that always created a laugh. But the teatro served as an organizing tool, and it made things visible that were perhaps a little difficult to understand at the beginning. I'll never forget a moment on the picket line early on when someone was on the bullhorn talking about dignidad, and a campesino came up to me and said, what's dignidad? He didn't understand. Yeah, dignity. What's dignity? And it was a good question because it stopped me for a moment. How do you define dignity? Self-respect, the ability to stand up for what you feel is right. And he got it, you know, but we did an acto about it later, you know, about dignity. And this is what we were fighting for.
So it's education.
Yeah.
But now the teatro was part of a whole cultural explosion. There were, you know, I think about Andy Cermeño's cartoons and the Malcriado. I think about the posters, the murals that came out. Talk a little bit about how culture became a tool in general, not just the teatro, but the whole use of culture.
Without any money, the union had to survive on the basis, I think, of cultural traditions and the generosity of Mexican culture in terms of food, in terms of gestures, you know, the abrazos, the support that you got for being part of the larger family of the huelga. All of that began to express itself in cultural terms. First and foremost are the religious rituals, the aspects, you know, that Caesar embraced. And the image of the Virgen de Guadalupe, the masses, the baptisms, all those were personal cultural events within the strike, but they were also politicized because they were huelga events. And in that way, too, music really quickly, very quickly, became a part of the movement. The first corrido was written as early as 1962 about the union by a woman named Rosa Gloria. And when I joined the strike, it was a very natural expression that corridos had to be part of the movement. And so the teatro became the musical branch, you know, the organized musical branch of the huelga. And we began to translate Solidarity Forever, Solidaridad para Siempre, We Shall Not Be Moved, No Nos Moverán, Nosotros Venceremos, which is We Shall Overcome. And we literally translated in some cases, you know, and adapted the music, and people caught up to them. They still sing those songs. They're again, an intrinsic part of the cultural expression. The corrido, the ranchera, and even the hymn, you know, the various hymns that evolved, really a cappella, because...
Well, De Colores is a religious song.
De Colores was a Cursillista song that I heard for the first time in Oakland the night that I chased Caesar across the bridge. And when I was in Delano, he says, do you remember that song that they were singing in the church in Oakland? And I said, yes, I do. I do remember it. And he says, well, do you think the teatro could sing it at the meeting? So we learned it, and it became part of course, the spirit and the identity of the huelga. The same way with the campesino applause, you know, an organized applause. We introduced that, you know, these things were just, we didn't think about them. We just did them because they were part of our everyday life, and it seemed the most natural thing to do.
And even though the teatro wasn't primarily a visual organization, the same thing was happening with pictures and comics and graphic images, too.
We got a lot of ideas directly from Andy Cermeño and the sketches, you know, the brilliant cartoons that he created for El Malcriado, the Patroncito, Don Coyote, Don Sotaco. We started dramatizing these. You know, Felipe Cantú, the actor, the campesino actor, became Don Sotaco, you know, and Don Coyote was great. It was a character. I mean, he was made for teatro, you know, but he was a cartoon first, so we just utilized him as a cartoon type. The Patroncito, by all means, almost a commedia type, you know, with the nose and the glasses and the hat and the cigar. That's all we needed, and the sign. And people knew instantly, oh, that's the grower, you know. So there was that cross-feeding. And by the same token, I mean, people brought stuff. I brought stuff from San Francisco that I'd collected over the years, pictures of Zapata, of Pancho Villa. And I worked on the Malcriado and did a number of covers and articles and translated. And so all that stuff went into the Malcriado. So there was cross-feeding. There was cross-feeding. People brought songs. They brought implements. They brought different versions, you know, of artwork utilizing the Huelga Eagle, which became part of the identity and the atmosphere of the Huelga. Filipino Hall was transformed by posters and by paintings and, you know, different banners that people created with their own hands. And so it was a direct cultural expression, you know, sustaining us. And it was that way, too, with the early strike camp, which was an old farm labor camp that we used. Mm-hmm. And the strike store was there, and our first kitchen was there. And, you know, we used to paint on the fence and do all kinds of stuff just to create the atmosphere.
Now, part of that synergy was that what was happening in Delano was really energizing people in cities, that you can say the teatro inspiring a theater movement in the cities. And so it wasn't just sucking energy into Delano, it was spreading energy out, wasn't it? Becoming part of what that new Chicano identity was.
We started to tour with the Teatro Campesino right after the March of Sacramento, which was the spring of 66. Before that, I mean, it had been solidly Delano. And with the March of Sacramento, we were exposed to thousands and thousands of people from the Bay Area and from all over the country that were with us. And that was very encouraging, a real boost for us. And out of that came invitations and so to the teatro to perform. And so we always had problems finding wheels because there were no cars and we had no car of our own. So we used to borrow a station wagon, you know, whenever we could, and head up to San Francisco, to Berkeley. Stanford, I think, sponsored our first show. And we didn't even have banners. We didn't have anything. We just had our masks, and we had a few signs, and we set them out in the open. And there was no backstage. People could see us. And so we started. We got into it, right? And people saw the immediacy of it. They saw the fact that we were related to very specific, hardcore issues that the huelga evoked. And so it was reminiscent, really, of an old kind of theater in new form. Another magazine down?
Okay, that's the end of camera roll 162. Now going to 163, our next take will be take 3. We're going to stay on this sound roll.
Because the cultural expression that was emerging out of the huelga was so Mexican in a way, you know, it became a real rallying cry for anyone that could identify with it. The teatro started to tour in the fall of 1966 through the universities, drumming up support for the boycott, which was starting to take shape. And we took the huelga actos, we took the music, and started to hit all the state colleges, community colleges, the universities, whatever, all the way up and down the state and up into the Northwest. And the response was electric. We could see that there was a presence on campus, that there were Chicano organizations that were beginning to form. And they used the huelga in that sense to organize and to focus the attention of other students. And they used the symbol of the huelga eagle as a way. And to some extent, in a short time, the use of teatro itself became an implement in the organization of Chicanos on campus. The visual imagery came naturally. The idea that murals could reflect the same idea, that posters could really catalyze a concept, you know, put it visually before a lot of people. Grew out of Delano, but it took root in the campuses as well and in community organizations. And so you began to see this tremendous response, this growth of posters and imagery that was emerging from Chicano artists. I think it was an opportunity, same way it was an opportunity for me as a playwright and as a director, you know, to express something. The huelga was also a vehicle for visual artists to channel their art, and for poets to begin to write poetry, and for musicians to begin to write songs. And so it was the spark, really, that was needed, because the urge to create, to express, had been there for some time. It was just waiting for the huelga to come along to set it off.
And in a way, even though they were in the city, it became their cause too, didn't it?
My experience with urban centers throughout my life had been that a lot of farm workers live in cities. When I was growing up, I used to see families, I made friends actually over several years, families that would come from East LA, you know, to work in the same fields. It didn't matter that they were living in an urban area. Los Angeles was rural anyway up until very recent times. You know, there were fields right outside of LA, all of Orange County, all of the San Fernando Valley. All of that was field work, you know, was for workers who lived in the middle of a huge urban area. So they could relate to it. And if they couldn't relate to it personally, they could relate through parents. They could relate through grandparents. And it became then part of their family history and part of their family imperative to come together and to join and support the strike in any way that they could from the city. And I think that the cultural expression just made it all come together. It gelled and glued the whole movement together in that sense.
Of course, that doesn't quite explain how people who weren't Mexicans responded in the same way. I mean, they didn't respond the same way, but it provoked a different set of responses that was also positive, too.
I'll tell you, it is my feeling that one of the most ignored subjects in American history is the whole history of the labor movement. And, you know, we have this impression somehow that America's a middle-class country and that there's been a lot of prosperity and people have lived in cities. But the presence of most Americans in cities is really only part of this century. Up until the 1920s, until the 1930s, people lived on farms in great numbers. So it was a recent memory, you know, that we were evoking. People knew what hard work was. They knew what working in the fields and working on farms was all about. And if they didn't, their parents could tell them also. They didn't want to go back to the fields, and no one can blame them for that. But it was not such a far-fetched concept as you might imagine. You know, I really look at this distinction between rural and urban as not a huge issue in the 1960s. It's more of an issue now, I think. The lines have really solidified and been drawn. But in 1965, there was still an opportunity to relate to the Dust Bowlers. There was still an opportunity to relate to the people that had grown up picking cotton, you know, alongside anybody else that was out there. And so it was possible to tap into that sense of labor justice in America, which is still there, frankly. I think we've all suffered. The Reagan administration really gutted the importance and the essential quality of the labor movement in this country, but it had been building for a while. When the huelga came along, it served as a reminder of what the labor movement had been through in the 30s. And so that brought a lot of people in, you know, from the unions. And they regaled us with all kinds of stories about how their unions had been, you know, the steel workers, the auto workers. All these people were our friends. And they're still there, you know, they are still there. The only thing is that it has been forgotten. And there aren't enough reminders to people in general that without the labor movement and without working people and without unions, we're going to be in deep trouble in this country, I think, that you cannot continue to take away jobs and opportunities from people without some kind of severe impact, you know, on the national character and the spirit as a whole.
Well, it's here.
Yes.
Let's switch gears a little bit and talk about César himself. Try and help us bring him to life, because, you know, as we were saying, people who knew him absorbed his personality and knew what his qualities were, but to everyone else, he's an icon. He's a symbol. He's not a real person. And you knew him very well. How can you give us some insight into who he was?
I would say that if there's any word that describes César, he was a doer. I mean, he was dedicated to creating change, not talking about it. He didn't enjoy, you know, having these long, drawn-out philosophical discussions about social justice or about ideologies. He knew a problem, and he wanted to do something about it. He knew that there was a serious problem having to do with wages and working conditions with farm workers because he had lived it, and that the only way that you could resolve those problems are by having some kind of mediated exchange between employers and workers, right? That's the union contract. Those are the negotiations. And he wasn't talking about anything so far-fetched. I mean, we are talking about cold water in the fields when it's scalding hot out in the field, and there was nothing. There were no bathrooms out there, not even for the women. Now, you consider, you're out there miles out in the middle of the field. There's no visible crop. There's nothing but rows out there, and people are out there weeding the crop. Where do women go to the bathroom? They would be forced to go out behind the parked cars and walk a mile or two to get there and a mile or two to get back because they were out in the middle of the fields. If they could get permission to leave their hose, the short hole, whatever it is they were working, to get out there. In most cases, they were not allowed to do that. So it was like real slave labor conditions that were reminiscent of the early part of this century and the late 19th century, in which you had sweatshops, and these were literal sweatshops. So given those conditions, well, something was bound to happen, and César was one who kept saying from the very beginning, from the time that he was like a teenager, he kept saying, something has to be done.
But there was something unique about him, because a lot of people have said that and have not been able to pull it off. But he had something else that motivated you and me and everyone else whose life he touched to give that effort. And that's the hard thing to put your finger on.
He was able to cut away the rhetoric. He didn't have any rhetoric to begin with. He brought to the struggle his experience. He brought his personal sense of the injustice of it all that every worker has experienced. And that's where he kept his focus. If anything, his rhetoric probably got spiritual more than anything else. But even then, I mean, he wasn't one to preach. You know, he wasn't one to go out and give a big lengthy oration to anybody. He talked very simply and very directly about what needed to be done. And he listened. He would sit and listen to people. And they would, in turn, then begin to speak about what their problems were. So he felt that by coming together, agreeing that something had to be done, and then working together, something could happen. César was extremely brilliant. That's sometimes forgotten. He was a genius in his own way. And that word is often misused, I think, too often, because it means, you know, it means someone that's erratic, somebody that creates something unusual. But what César was a genius about was our humanity. And he was able to look for a solution. He had this thing about a magic bullet. He was always looking for magic bullets, meaning that he saw the entire structure of a problem. And he said, it doesn't need to be completely overthrown. It doesn't need to be completely disrupted. It only needs to be touched at the appropriate place. This demonstration will do it. Or if the boycott was based on this, if you put pressure here, you get responses over there. And he had a game that he always played, you know, that it was, I think, probably inspired a little bit by the movies of the 30s and the 40s. And he played this game with Richard, with Manuel, with his contemporaries in the union, and it was a little bit of George Raft, that kind of defiant, and I think he owes some of that to the Pachuco era, you know, that the tough guy, and yet he was always with a smile, always with a sense of a laugh, and yet there was a strategy, there was a plan, there was plan A, plan B, plan C. If plan A didn't work, there was always B and C to go to. There was always something to fall back on. And so he didn't just seek a particular direction, he analyzed the whole problem, anticipated what the opposition might do, and then calculated and maneuvered, and he made it a game. He made it a strategic game and got all of us involved. We all knew what plan A was, plan B, and plan C. And if plan A didn't work, he'd turn and say, let's go to plan C. Boom, we went right there, right? So this was a guy that was organizing and maneuvering to win.
Hang on a second. We want to change on this. Have we got another one?
No, we don't.
Oh, can we take like a 5-minute break?
Yeah. Good. What are we doing?
We're actually reloading.
Okay.
Quick point.
Catch up on some calls.
Okay, that was the end of camera roll 163, and that's the end of this sound roll. That was take number 3. 4 will be starting on the next roll. Goodbye. Okay, this is sound roll number 78 for Fight in the Fields Paradigm Productions. You have a minus 8 to be referenced in the following module, which equals 0 VU. Okay, this is continuing the interview with Luis Valdez. Our next take, camera roll is on, is camera roll 164, and our next take will be take 4.
This is take 4, marker.
Okay, so Luis, you were telling me about the game that Caesar used to play.
It was... The games that Caesar played were, I think, a direct outgrowth of his youth in a way, and how he approached life as, not as a game, but as a strategy, that in order to be able to get from A to Z, you had to maneuver and navigate. And so his models for all of that were all the popular heroes that have appeared on movie screens in America since the beginning of Hollywood. There were stories that he had heard. The Mexican Revolution, to be sure, except he didn't use violence. What he used was tactics. What he used was an effort to try to circumvent a problem by surrounding it, you know, with a different set of conditions. And one of the things that he used to love, for instance, was to take people for rides. If there was a question about someone in the Union, and there often was, because we were infiltrated more often than once, by agent provocateurs who were, particularly in that time of violence in 1968, were creating violence on the picket line. And rather than confront them publicly out on the picket line or in the Union Hall or what have you, Caesar would take people on rides. And he would climb in the car, and Manuel and Richard or Fred or Dolores, somebody would go. The car would be packed. Whoever the individual was going to be questioned would go, and they'd ride out into the country, right? And they'd stay out there until they got all the answers that were needed. It didn't end with a bullet, you know, like the mafia did. It ended with dismissal if it didn't work out for that person. They were asked to leave. And it was, I think, quite significant that they did this on wheels, they did this in cars, because this was a very mobile strike. It had to be. We were covering 1,000 square miles of territory. The roving picket line became not just a symbol of the Union, but the working tool to reach the strikers. And so in his own way, Caesar did a lot of working and decision-making in a car, going someplace, and questioning what was happening. A lot of his meetings were taking place when he was going from Delano to San Francisco or Los Angeles or what have you, right? And occasionally he would read. But more often than not, he would meet. And I was in on a lot of those meetings, and they were significant. They were like staff meetings on wheels.
I know, I was in on some of them. Is there anything else that, in terms of a moment or an incident with Caesar, something that really sticks in your mind that shows people the way he was or the qualities he had?
Caesar did not become the spiritual icon that he became in people's minds right away. When he started, he was a farm worker. And his eating habits, his sleeping habits, the way that he lived at home was basically no different than the way other farm workers lived. There were some notable examples, exceptions. Helen used to have, for instance, a whole sarape full of buttons, which she began to collect, and she still has it. She hasn't displayed it anymore, but there were all thousands and thousands of buttons. That was the difference, right? Farmworker home with this big banner, sparape, with all kinds of buttons. I remember early on, Caesar used to drink and smoke. A lot of people don't know that. And I had the opportunity to see him on a couple of Christmas parties when he'd had too much to drink. He was benign. He was very kind. He went around blessing people with wine, for instance. That was his his way of getting drunk. You know, he'd go around and bless people. And, you know, we all cracked up about it. He would love to sing. He'd love to sit around singing corridos. And he used to smoke like a fiend, frankly, early on. Lots of cigarettes. He drank too many Diet Cokes or Cokes. But all of that began to fall away. All of that, as time went by, as he changed, as the movement changed him, and as he changed the movement, he stopped smoking. He stopped eating fat. I remember eating at his home and having frijoles chinitos, which are refried beans, presented to him by Helen with as much love as any wife could offer her husband. It was tremendous. I remember that meal. I still remember it, you know, because it was a meeting that we were having at his house, and here she served us and served Caesar, and he loved that kind of fat-ridden food, you know, at the beginning, right? After a while, he stopped eating even beans with lard in them. He became someone who lived on the basis of a macrobiotic diet. He had to watch his diet because he needed the energy, and heavy food drained him. Same way with smoking, it drained him. So anything that interfered with what he was doing, that took away his energy, was not good, and he abandoned it. And, of course, it took on another character. It took on a spiritual character. People say, well, he's fasting, you know, or he's a very spiritual guy. But he took to eating fruit because, one, it was healthy, and they'd serve him a whole half a watermelon, for instance, and that would be his lunch. And he'd sit there, and everybody else was having chile verde, and I was having tortillas and meat, and he's in there eating his whole watermelon. And people felt that was funny. It was strange, Caesar eating his watermelon. But he was getting energy from it. And he looked good. If you look at those films, considering the amount of the number of hours, he must have been putting in 20 hours a day, daily, for years. He looked great. He looked great. Now, occasionally he collapsed. His body just gave out on him, and his back gave out. He had a bad back. One leg was shorter than the other. And after the fast, he really had to watch it, right? He had to regulate his diet in order to be able to stay on his feet. But all of that was part of changes that were taking place in him physically and mentally. Self-discipline became a real key feature of his personality. He read a lot of Gandhi, and I suspect that everything having to do with sexual abstinence, to not eating meat, to staying away from fat, to stopping the Diet Cokes, just drinking water, all of that was part of a whole transformation that was personal. And yet, as it turned out, it was movement-wide because he inspired a lot of people. They said, this is a man who is doing more than an ordinary man would do. These are extraordinary measures that he is taking personally. And I admired that very much. I saw him most of his fasts. I was with him and tried to help him. And I'll never forget how lucid he was. Even in his last major fast in 1988, he was extremely lucid. Because the theater was always instrumental in setting up, you know, whatever public event he wanted, and he knew exactly what he wanted, and he was still able to delineate what arrangements he wanted set up and how he was going to go about it. He was physically weak, but mentally tremendously strong. And you know, I admired Caesar from the very beginning. I'm not a follower in most senses of the word. You know, I'm fairly independent. I prefer to do my own work. But Caesar is the one guy that I can say early on that I followed, you know, and quite willingly, because there was something about him, and I probably speak for a lot of people in this respect, that allowed you to follow him. There wasn't an ego there, you know. You didn't feel that you were doing it and Caesar was somehow taking the credit. He didn't want the credit. And also, if you were like going to put out and sacrifice yourself, Caesar was there first. I'll never forget being called by the Union, by Caesar actually, to go from Delano to Borrego Springs in 1966 in the summer. We were organizing the DiGiorgio Ranch there. It was very hot, over 100 degrees, 105, 110, in the middle of the Borrego Springs, the San Diego area, the desert. And we arrived late at night, and we couldn't find the Huelga headquarters. There wasn't a Huelga headquarters. They were staying out in a state park. And so we arrived, and the headlights shone out into the park and into the desert, and I could see these bundles, these we call bultos, you know, these mounds in the desert. And there were men sleeping there. So we got our sleeping bags and proceeded to go out there. And I bumped into somebody. and Caesar rolled over and, oh, okay, then, yeah, you can just lie down here. And he was one of these bunches of people sleeping out in the desert sand. And we were up before dawn. And they, actually, Caesar was arrested. He was placed in a truck, and he spent the better part of a day and a night almost being cooked alive together with a couple of workers. He stripped down to his shorts, you know, when he was arrested and taken in. So that kind of stuff, when you see your leader doing that, it makes you want to do it. It makes you want to stick your neck out. And, of course, with that sense of humor that was part of the Union, if you got beaten, you know, as I did and as a lot of people did, what you'd look for are bruises, you know, that you could use. You'd say, well, they gave me a real good one here. You know, this is good for the news. They're going to see this. But that was the only way that we could respond, you know, to the horror, really, of being attacked. After people started to get killed, there was a visible change in Caesar. He felt personally responsible. I mean that in every sense of the word, personally responsible for the life and death of people in the Union. And he didn't feel that it was worth it. His magic bullet did not entail taking anybody's life. Not the workers, not the growers, not anybody. He wanted a non-violent solution that would bring people to their senses. And to the extent that he encapsulated that in his being, all the way to the end of his days, he was a leader that I would follow again.
Good.
Okay. That's the end of camera roll 164. That was take number 4. Yes, and I need room time.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I'm sorry. We need room time. Yeah. Everyone sit still.
Okay, room time. Everybody quiet, please.
Great. Thanks. You're welcome.
Okay. That's room tone, and that's the end of the interview with Luis Valdez and the end of the sound roll. Goodbye.